And welcome to this third edition of 'Cause I'm Humanity. So I'm recording this podcast from a very special place. First Liverpool recorded podcast. And I've chosen to relocate to Liverpool. And it's where I'm from. It's where I feel comfortable. And I suppose I can tell you more about why in this episode. So I left London about a week and a half ago, and it was after almost 5 years of living there, and I had lots of reasons. I think the reasons that you'll hear most are it was so expensive, people so unfriendly, it's really stressful, maybe really anxious, and those are really valid. I arrived there, I was doing my degree in languages, Russian and Spanish, and that course lasted 4 years, and I finished that last year. And for a year, I suppose, entered the rat race, or attempted to. And I think the finale for me of my London experience really was the Notting Hill Carnival. So I'd been to the carnival once before, I think 2 years ago, with an ex who shall not be named. And this was a particular experience, a peculiar experience, as a white experience. It was a white upper class experience, and there was lots of spotting of Made in Chelsea people sticking around one stage. There were some people called Martha and Millie and Ophili and Lily and Silly and Chitty and Cunty and Pissy. And, you know, I just thought, okay, well, this is how Notting Hill is supposed to be experienced, supposed to be. Because, you know, at that point, I was on the path of the trophy mulatto with a white husband. And I was, as I thought, content with that. Little did I know, the fuckery is happening behind the scenes. And I felt myself in this prison. And I was looking at the black people dancing, at their dark skin, from this outsider's perspective, from this white gaze which had been forced upon me. And this year at the carnival, this is the first time when I experienced what the black gaze is, and it was one of the most joyous, triumphant experiences of my life. Because being born a mulatto, a person of African and European heritage, unless you're born in Africa, then you're going to internalize the white gaze. Especially if you're brought up with a imperialist parent like I was. So what was different for me was I was walking along, was walking towards my friends, mix of black friends, white friends, who were all the way up in, you know, northwest London, not northwest London, but north of that part of West London. And it would take like 60 minutes to walk there, so I just thought maybe I'll meet them halfway. But then I had a group of people stop me. And there was a guy there, he had these big muscles, a black guy. And I, obviously, living in London, if you're queer and if you're brown, especially if you're of African descent, you are going to be very well attuned to the words batty boy, bamba clat, blood clat. And I turned round and I saw him and I was completely triggered. A masculine black man cannot be nice to me in London. That is what I've been conditioned into believing because it has been my experiences. But, thank God, hallelujah, exception to that dastardly rule, he brought me into his friendship group, he introduced me to his friends, Kenyan friends, Ugandan friends, he's Nigerian Scouser. And they just took me under their wing and adopted me, and that was it. And then we went to the house, and they invited me in for some drinks, and then they put on this amazing playlist of, what's it called? Of Afrobeats, and it was twerking at the best, and then the guys were lifting weights to the beat of the songs. It was hilarious. But I'm just like, this is it. This is how society can, must, should, will be, you know. This is how African society should be, where they love me because I've got my own special flavour. And the women, because these were all heterosexual people as well. And the women, we all love them because they've got the special flavour. And the masculine men, we love them because they've got the special flavour. But, you know, I suppose you could say I'm in the middle of the two. But that's great. That's wonderful. And actually, when you're in an environment of love and acceptance like that, just unquestioned, it just makes the idea that somebody would not want to talk to you because of the clothes you're wearing, it just makes that idea so completely absurd. It's just absurd. It's unfathomable that a person could actually think in that way, but people do. So, I went out with them, we were following the flow, it's twerking, and you know, people, it's like, you know, if you look into the sky and you see kind of bird dance and everything's just perfectly in sync. It was completely like that. One comes and grabs it, and then you start twerking with them, and then you start twerking on someone else, and then your friend comes over, and then this happens, and you meet someone else, and then you phone this one, and you go over here, and you drink this thing, and you take a picture over here, and it was just fantastic in the sunshine. What a glorious day. So this day was glorious up until the whiteys arrived. And how it came to be was, as I said before, I had centered the black gaze. And that meant I felt like a black person. And this is for the first time in my life where I don't feel like, in some way, a white person coming into black spaces, but proving that I'm black enough to be there. You know, that's really how I feel. And this was so special. But what I noticed from that, because when you're living in the white world and living in white society, you really do normalize all kinds of abuses that happen every single day in a way to survive. Because I think if you don't normalize it, you don't have those psychological, emotional, spiritual tools to actually deflect them and understand them for what they are, historical tools as well. They will send you batshit fucking crazy. So I think the first instance was when I was sat down with all my friends. All my friends are dark-skinned black people. And again, just cherishing that feeling of being the lightest skinned person there. It was beautiful. It was beautiful to be in those people's presence and just look at them and see them as the norm, as dark skinned people as the norm, and me as accepted into the group, but grateful to be a part of it, you know, despite the fact that my skin is lighter than theirs. You know, it's a humbling and wonderful experience, especially when society wants to, in a very toxic, demonic way, push you up as more beautiful, more relevant, more intelligent, more deserving, more etc., etc., etc. So when I was sat down chatting to my friend, and we hadn't brought it up, because talking about white people when you are a black person is never going to be a positive thing. If you're talking about a person who happens to be white, then that's one thing. But when you're talking about white people as a group, it's never going to be a nourishing environment. It's a time when you talk about trauma. And we hadn't done that because we're focusing on ourselves, as we should do. But one man, an American man, a white man, a gay man, he appeared out of nowhere as I was chatting to my friend. He had his phone in his hand. He had his selfie mode already activated, camera app open, ready to go. And then he turned to me with his glasses on and said, oh, he's actually sat down with us. I just really want to get a photo. I'm just visiting. Amazing. So he started snapping photos of me. And then I had to switch, like, oh, here they fucking come. Here come the fucking settlers. Here come the fucking colonizers. Here they fucking come. The white supremacists, they've fucking arrived. And they've got their iPhones ready to snap pictures of our black fucking bodies. But of course he flew straight to me. He ignored my friend, the Nigerian scout, so the masculine man. They ignored him and they came straight to the delicate-looking mulatto. So I was taking his photos and I said to him, are you going to pay for me then? Are you going to pay to take a photo with me? And I think I've noticed with these oblivious white people, these white people who are much like mechanical robots, well-programmed mechanical robots, they do not compute something that does not blend with their circuitry. So they have been 01001011100111 to believe they are the superior race and anyone who doesn't look like them are their property. Much like people feel when they go to zoos. They and their children feel obliged and entitled to touch those animals, to take photos with them, and they want those animals to perform for them in the same way that they want us to perform for them. So he took no notice when I said, do you want to pay for me to have these photos taken? He didn't register that. His face, he didn't even flinch, he didn't even react. And then he took more. I said, are you actually going to ask for my permission? And he didn't even flinch at that. He didn't react. And then he said, thank you so much. Stood up and walked away. And my friend was like, what the fuck just happened? What just happened? And I said, I'm so glad that you're sat here with me for you to experience my life. This happens all the time. It's like, really? Yeah. Yeah. And it's the realization that they get ignored, but I am the link to Africa. They see me as this supple body who is laying down across the Mediterranean, and they can just walk all over me, get to Africa, plunder it, and then run away. That photo that he got was the same photo that he'd get when he goes to, I don't know, some fucking orphanage in Uganda and takes pictures with all the smiling Negro children and says, OMG, love Africa, changed my life. That's the same motivations he had when he took pictures of me sitting down with this little orphan child, this mulatto child with his gollywog hair. That was the same motivation that he came from. That's not the end of the story. No, no, no. No, no, no. Another whitey came, another white man with his phone camera. He arrived and he didn't even come to sit next to me. He just had his phone out, had it aimed on me and was just grinning. Started taking pictures, just grinning. I looked at him and asked the same questions to him. Are you going to pay me? Again, he didn't react. He didn't flinch. He just carried on grinning, taking photos. And then after that, he came over and said, you see, it's my birthday. It's my 60th. It's my 60th. And then he took another photo with me. I said, are you going to ask for my permission? Yeah, you have a great carnival. See you later. Bye. Thanks for the photo. Bye. He didn't even react. Are these people able to hear my words? Are they able to hear what I'm saying? Because they are human beings. They are human. They must be. And when a person is saying, don't take my photo, they must be able to understand the words that I'm saying. It is in English. I was speaking in English to them. But are they able to hear what I'm saying? So my friend was horrified because this happened within the space of 3 minutes, these two instances. I was raped by these men. And I, even if I said don't do it, they still went in and raped and plundered and left with their booty that they'll be showing to all their friends when they fly back to New York City. Or he goes up to Doncaster, wherever the fuck he lives. So from that point, I had solidarity with this friend of mine. Grace is her name. And as the evening went on, there were several instances where I was again further fetishized. I was walking along and there was a group of young white people, teenagers, 19, 20, 21, whatever. And there was a blonde girl, I think she had a backwards cap on, these blue eyes, I remember. And she just saw me and she gawped. Gawped. And the most beautiful gazelle she ever saw, and the most beautiful baboon she ever saw, and the most beautiful cheetah she ever saw on her free safari trip to Notting Hill on that day. Negroes can actually look like that. Wow. Oh my God. If that happened 2 years ago, I would have taken that as a compliment. That's validation from Whitey. That's validation that I am somehow closer to human. 2 years ago, I would have been looking at the faces of white people, looking for their approval, looking for them to smile at me, looking. And a lot of the time, they wouldn't give it. They'd look away. And I'd carry on seeking, yearning that validation, that affection from white people who are at an event that was created by a black woman in order to combat white supremacy. They now feel comfortable to go on safari there. So, similarly to what happened before, and I began to tell them what they were doing, what these white people were doing to me, my friends, and I was walking along. And moments after that woman did, Becky gawped at me. I walked past a group of white men, this blonde man. And he immediately grabbed my arm and said, you look amazing. And just like what I said to the blonde girl, which was beautiful, right? And all her friends are, oh, he speaks, it speaks. I said to this man, I know. And then he just entered into the state of incredulity. I know. Because he is so used to his voice being valued and cherished that for me to say, I know, I already know I'm beautiful. I don't need your validation to know it. That sent him into a state of disbelief. So yeah, I'm sipping my tea. It's actually coffee. But yeah, spilling that coffee for y'all. And my friend saw it. They saw it happen. They didn't know what he says, but they saw him grab me. And they're like, what the fuck? What the fuck? So I told him what I said to him, and they laughed. You know, we laugh, you know. Children of trauma, we laugh. That's how we survive. That's how we stay strong. We laugh. We laugh it off. Ha ha, you showed him, huh? But we shouldn't have to. So, things continue. I go into my friend's flat again. And, you know, it's just... I get to meet her daughter, who was one of the floats. And, well, it's friend's daughter was in one of the floats. And that's beautiful. And again, I'm just feeling like, wow. I'm being accepted into... a black family, a black working class Notting Hill family. This is gorgeous. This is the London I've been waiting for. The London experience I've been waiting for. And, you know, I'm eating salad, a piece of chicken. It's gorgeous and fabulous. And I'm sat on the street. And there is a... kind of a bar, and there's a sound system. By that time, all the sound systems have gone off, but, you know, one of my friends says, isn't it funny? After all the other sound systems have gone down, this is the only one that's allowed to remain open. And who is it owned by, and who is it catering for? White ears. And... we decide to go over and dance, you know. And then all of a sudden, My Humps comes on, which is hilarious. I have been dancing there. That has been my jam since I was 11, 12 years old. Walking to school every morning, listening to it. Obsessed with the video. Just amazing. So there's one part where... and all along the dance, like, we were killing it. Amazing. This is my friend... Faith, let me killing it, and you know, Felicia is very well known, and white people do use the internet, so they will know what that means. So I decided, let's call them Fifi. So Fifi, and this is what Fifi does when she sees a black person in pure black joy mode. Fifi wants to get a little bit of it. Fifi wants to, you know, just like the Kardashians would like to get a bit of that blackness. She comes in and she starts kind of wobbling and wibbling and you know, kind of flinching away as Fifi does on the dance floor. And I was just like, Fifi, go away. This is not for you. Leave. Just leave us alone. So we just give Fifi the hand, turn our back on her. She doesn't get the message. She comes back twice, three times. You know, it's bullshit, but at least she's not touching our hair. And there's one point where I'm just like, right, Fifi, you're going to get it now. It's the rapper goes, I'm at a girl down at the disco. She say, hey, your disco. I could be a baby. You can be my honey. Let's spend time, not money. Mix your milk with my cocoa butter. So I find a random white girl. And you know what? This woman is going to be a fucking prop in my choreography. Fucking get with it. Oh, I'm turning the tables. Oh, isn't this scandalous? So I point as it goes. Mix your milk with my cocoa butter. Pointing at me. Yeah, baby, this is the cocoa. Because I'm blacker than night, aren't I? In your eyes, I'm blacker than night. And her friend looks at her like, oh my God, as though Michael Jackson just lifted her onto the stage. Oh my God, I'm being validated by blackness. Oh, their pussies were so wet with delight, with rapture. So please, I've got to give them that gift. And at the end of the song, towards the end of the song, there's a man creeping up towards my friend. And when Fergie says, no drama, No drama, so don't pull on my hand, boy. You ain't my man, boy. I'm just trying to dance, boy. And move my heart. This is where it goes. I point right at him and say, you can look, but don't you touch it, Amma. And then he backs the fuck off and steps off, my friend. And this is it, you know. Girl power, femme power, male power, just black power, baby. So the music stops, the song ends, and we strut off the dance floor, and we leave those motherfuckers dazed with our brilliance. But only 3 minutes worth of it. That's all they deserve, that's all they need. So I am cooling off after that, and I'm leaning on a lamppost, really feeling that block party, Bed-Stuy vibes. It's 1989, honey, and Brooklyn Bed-Stuy. And again, just to reiterate how important this day was, I had stopped seeking the validation of white men, as I had done before in the previous visit to the carnival, and I had actively made the conscious decision to not even look at them, to just decide they're not here for me. They shouldn't be here. They're not even existing in my visual field. And sounds radical, but that's what I've been trained to do every single day, but on the flip side, to ignore black bodies and to center white bodies. So to do that on the flip side, that's radical, that's punk, that's wild. But that's the reality of white supremacy. So following on from that, I had two white men walking towards me. It's probably a straight guy and a gay guy, or maybe two gay guys. And one of them was like chatting. They saw me on the lamppost. So I'm just wearing these little red dungarees. My nipples on show. And they start talking amongst each other. And then he kind of like eggs him on. It was going to be his wingman or whatever. So he starts walking towards me. I look at him. I think, let's do something special here. I stop him in his tracks with the words, can I help you? And what happens is this man's direction, like a ship that has just changed direction, he walks straight towards me. And as soon as I say, can I help you? His direction completely turns and he carries on walking. And I see him walking away. And I laugh to myself. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Not used to that, are you? Mr. White Boy, not used to that, are you? Well, it just happened, honey. And guess what? It's a special day. It is not in Hill Carnival. Oh, ho! So, just enjoying that moment. And guess what happens? Two white boys, little blondie with blonde eyebrows and blue eyes, comes over. This little cherub comes to me and starts analysing my physical form, looking at my clothes, saying, wow, look at the hair. Oh, you're so beautiful. You're the most gorgeous man I've ever seen. Wow. Start looking at my nails. Wow. Wow, wow, wow. Wow's all around. And before you start thinking, oh, well, that's a compliment, isn't it? It's not a compliment. They're using me as an instrument to confirm to themselves that they are not racist, because they have found the most beautiful human that has graced their lives in all of their existence on this world. You know, if this person, I can find them attractive, that means I can't be racist. It means I can't be racist. I'm being used as an instrument for their own virtual signaling. And there's no virtue being signaled to me, it is to themselves, for they live in a mirror. They are so self-obsessed and narcissistic that they are surrounded by mirrors, and that's how they see the world. They see their face reflected back at them. When they look out and they don't see their own face, they think, ah, they must not be human, because, of course, I am the only representation of human. So, that was what was happening right there. And my friend, you know, saw them coming at me. And there were children as well. There were children witnessing this fetishization, this reenactment of colonialism. I thought, this is vile. Keep your vileness away from these children. These black children don't need to see your abomination, your abomination of a spirit. Leave. So, as they started to look at my nails, they said, yes, baby. So I went right up to one of them with his little open shirt, you know, because he's got his vintage cool shirt on. And I scratched him all the way down. I said, this is what they're used for. They're for scratching white boys' chests. Do you enjoy that? And he just, he didn't know what to do with himself. But after that, I turned from him and he was dismissed. And all they could do was carry on walking. And they'll probably be thinking about that for the rest of their lives. But it's none of my business. Thank you. And I... And my friend Grace was saying, disgusting, they're like leeches. No, they are leeches. And it's like, yes, 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 yes. And it was just validation to know that what was happening to me was not right. It was just validation. And afterwards, I had a great night, but when I went home, I was talking about what happened to me, and now where was I? Sorry, I just got interrupted. So I got home and I started telling people I was staying with what Notting Hill Carnival was like. And I explained that it was wonderful on one end, but with that wonder came the realisation that I was being fetishised, and there was a brutal fetishisation. And I actually went to bed furious, you know, filled with these furious, angry, indignant thoughts. How dare they? The fucking pestilence, these white people, the pestilence in this world. They rape and they pillage and they grab and they don't even think twice about it. Pestilence, pestilence, pestilence. And that led to me the following morning writing a Facebook post about it. And I double thought about it, but at the end of the post, after writing, Notting Hill Carnival is the cheapest safari white people will ever go on, I wrote at the end of the post, I'm grateful to God I am not white. And that, I think, is the clincher. Anyone who has any closeted white supremacist views, that is really going to get them. How dare you tell me I'm not perfection, that you don't want to be me. I am the model of humanity. How dare you? And those are the responses I got in the post. And I think they ranged from, wow, my gosh, you used to be so nice, now you're all militant, oh my, such a shame, to, you are racist, how dare you say, you thank God for, you're not white, to one particularly horrendous, nasty, vicious, wicked person who tried to gaslight me on my Facebook post. They were immediately blocked, but they said, oh, sweetie, you're not a victim. Notting Hill Carnival's for everyone. I have volunteered there for the past 2 years. You need to get over your hateful feelings to people who just happen to be not of your skin colour. She couldn't bring herself to say white. If you ever want to ask me about this, just send me a message. Five kisses. And I'd had to block her straight away. Straight away. But you know, that leads me on to how useful social media has been for me in the past few months. In the past few months of becoming, you know, politically on the offensive, it's useful as a social experiment, if I'm honest. A social experiment that includes you and includes the world. And I think anyone who's a person of colour, or anyone who's a white person who's interested in not dehumanising and being an agent and abetting white supremacy, will have read articles on the certain behaviours that white people do, white fragility, gaslighting, spiritual bypassing, all of these different terms. And actually seeing it in practice is extremely helpful, because being person to person, another person's negative energy triggering at all these different things, and especially because people don't wait, it's not like a board game where you can allow the other person to think. No, people react instantaneously, which is dangerous. People can become violent, and people are more and more so becoming violent when their white supremacist views are challenged. So being able to use a platform like Facebook, Instagram as well, seeing who reacts and who doesn't, who are your white friends who remain silent, they watch but they're silent. The white friends who will mention your post and say, wow, that was really something, that was really inspiring, well done, but they will never publicly endorse you or send you messages. I've put a PayPal link on there for people who want to contribute to that. You know, that's something called virtue signaling I've found. And having these things happening, and you're like, I know that's not right, but what is that? What is the technical term for it? And there always is a technical term. And having friends at the other end of the phone to confirm those things is extremely helpful. And I really feel like this is a training for being an artist who is a person of colour, a black person. Because to be an artist and to be a black person, you are a politician, regardless if you want it or not. You know, some artists who've chosen to be completely apolitical, someone like Grace Jones. And I think that is not the path that I would like to go on myself. My mulatto privileges means that unless I really do interrogate how the world sees me and how I function in it, I'm just going to be an instrument and a tool for the furtherment of white supremacy. Which makes me think of something I wrote last night. And it was just like my own internal response to a documentary I was watching, which I'd really recommend, by Michael Moore, and I just discovered yesterday. And I was watching it, I was screaming at the TV, screaming, like, oh my God, this is happening in America. I thought it was bad, but I didn't know it was this bad. Things like water poisoning in Flint, Michigan, where the governor decided that he wanted to create a new pipe which would give more money for investors, and because that pipe was going into the factories, GM Motors, that meant, well, we need to give these, you know, the niggers of Flint some other water supply. Niggers and white poor people, but, you know, obviously to them, they're all niggers. So they hooked it up to basically this toxic lake that was used for industrial waste, and they connected that up to people's water supply. So people were pouring water from their taps and it was coming out brown, rust-coloured. And because there's no other water, children were drinking this. This is in America, by the way. This is like, what, 2016? Excuse me? And children have now been infected with lead. So there were people dying of Legionnaire's disease. And guess what? This was all happening, and the governor said, it's all safe to say, mistakes were made, it's horrific, but we can imagine, okay, this is what we expect of white supremacists, fine. But when Mr. Barry Obama, arrived in, you know, his POTUS mobile, people were filled with hope. Wow, a black man is coming. Now, I always had this sense of suspicion at Barack Obama calling himself black, because he's as black as I am.
His mother is Scottish, I believe. And his father is Luo from Kenya, which is my family's tribe. Little known fact, our grandmas know each other. And that means he's as black as I am. And I was never comfortable calling myself black. I mean, on one end, you could say it's because I didn't want to be fully associated with black. I wanted to have white as this kind of tool. But then on the other hand, it's, no, I receive different treatment from dark-skinned black people. I have a proximity to whiteness, which gives me privileges, economic privileges. My network is wider because of that, etc. I know how white people work. I know how to talk in white speak. And, you know, that is a privilege. And I felt like he was erasing that by not talking about it, not addressing it. So when he arrived in Flint, he had this press conference and he immediately said, "I'd like a glass of water." Can't do the Barry Obama voice. And then he drank from the water, supposedly drank, but he didn't. He just put it to his lips. He didn't drink it as a way of showing the people of Flint that there's nothing wrong with the water. They're just being hysterical. It's all been cured now. Gaslighting them. And when I was actually living in Birkenhead still, just before going to London, I was working in my auntie's salon. And there was a moment where I was horrified. And the people in there who worked there, you know, not a political bone in their body, just as there's no racist bone in their body, you know what I mean? And he said, "We are going to drop bombs on," I can't remember which Middle Eastern country it is now, lost track. Is it Syria or Afghanistan or one of them? "But the difference is, good people of America, we will not be deploying planes, so none of our American soldiers will die. No, we are just going to use drones." I watched this live on TV. My morality layers go bzz, 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 bzz. What am I watching? What? I remember speaking to like the one politically aware person in my year. I said, "But what's going on?" And she's like, "Well, no, they have to." And I saw that she and everyone else, they're so starved of black people in America, especially. I think just liberal, whatever we call liberal, whatever that word means. Liberals! They're so starved of goodness. And obviously America's been starved of black presidents or black presenting presidents that they can't hear a bad word about him because they really want him to be the Messiah. So anything that doesn't link up to that, it's cognitive dissonance. It doesn't meet their confirmation bias. So watching that documentary where he gaslit the people of Flint whose children were dying and how the people were so dejected and just bewildered, horrified, and he flew away and nothing was done. You know, they wanted a state of emergency to be declared, but he didn't do it. He just said, "No, it's fine." You know, it just confirms how someone like him, neoliberal, that word, and ultimately how dangerous mulattoes are. So this is something I wrote yesterday. I'll read it now. And I posted a picture of a Creole woman promenading with her Negress servant in New Orleans, 1867. What I wrote was, "We mulattoes are dangerous. Beware of us. We can use our blackness to win your hearts and faith, but some of us are committed to white supremacy. And the silken luxuries of capitalism with which it is twinned. Many of us act as undercover spies, reporting on the victimhood of our darker-skinned counterparts, dismissing their anger as overdramatic, whiny, and negative. The aroma of white dick is often so seductive that we will open ourselves to it with the gleeful wish that we will stand tall on the backs of our Negro brothers and sisters, reaping the benefits of white and black, accepted into the fold of white elite as the gracious mulatresse who praises the gods for her European features. And what's even more frightening about us is that none of these dastardly actions we make are conscious. I think it takes a lot to admit a person's role in something that you could say it's not our fault, this just is how it is, but really owning that and really seeing it for what it is, it takes a lot, I think. And when I look at someone like Barack Obama with his black wife, all I can see is that Creole woman with a Negress dark-skinned servant standing behind her as she steps forward. And I think the fact that, you know, former President Obama accepted huge amounts of money from corporations, is a man who is a believer in respectability politics, politics of respectability. If you just pull your trousers up and you start talking like a real American, then things are going to be fine. I think that's, for me, just proof that, sure, we can have a, in inverted commas, black president, but it comes at a cost. And it's really important, I think, for us in the United Kingdom, people living in London, people who consume American media, people who go on holiday to the United States, to take a genuine interest, makes it sound like it's an intellectual pursuit. Oh, well, I'm interested in the legacy of white supremacy in the United States of America. No, it's a passion and a responsibility to actually understand what happens across the pond, as they say. One thing that I have also used social media for is to test the loyalties of certain public figures. So there's a mulatto actress, British mulatto actress, who's now doing well in America. And I just had this feeling one day. I was walking around the Barbican at a exhibition about virtual reality. And I just thought of them. So I typed in their name and typed in racism, which I think is a really useful and effective way of figuring out a person's political leanings. And what I got was an article by the Telegraph. And when asked about what she thinks about racism in the industry, she said, "I honestly have never experienced racism." She went on to say that, "I believe affirmative action is condescending towards minorities." And another person who said exactly the same thing is Stacey Dash, which is Cher Horowitz's best friend in Beverly Hills High. And we all know she's gone on to this sunken space-fueled conservative political wildness. That girl is wilding. And she said exactly the same thing. So because this person is protected, this actress is protected by her perceived blackness, she can continue to be an advocate for white supremacy, and she can gain black roles that are intended for, you know, really intended for working class
black American women, she's able to take on those roles and mine those black women's pain in the same way that white people mine black, poor black people's pain. So really that person, after reading that article, I thought, well, let's put this to the test. So they had released a new film, and I saw in the wording of it, she was described as a black woman. And the actor who's playing alongside them was just described as a detective. So it's clear to me what was happening there. It's another confirmation that white skin is the norm and black people is the, you know, the step away from reality, which again just feeds into this more and more and more and more of we need whiteness to validate us. So I saw she posted it maybe 10 minutes before I commented, and I saw, woohoo, congrats, yahee, woohoo, woohoo. So I put congrats, and I put a little star on there. But then I questioned why they had pointed out her blackness and not his whiteness. Is this just not more confirmation that they wish to normalize their skin and denormalize ours? And a couple of days after, I checked on my comment and saw that she'd liked every single comment congratulating her. Woohoo, you go, girl. Can't wait to see it. Woohoo. But had ignored mine. So that really speaks volumes about this person's alignment, what this person has compromised in themselves in order to gain success, and really the tragedy that we are forced to do that. And again, she will be sabotaging the lives of black people, but in many ways, completely unaware. She just thinks that she's just being an actress, you know. An actress's place is not to be political, you know, she'd believe. And the people who bring politics into their profession, she'd be one of those people who'd very quietly, she'd speak about it with probably her white friends or other black friends of hers, if she has any, about, oh gosh, well, you know, I see the point, but, you know, bringing it in is really inappropriate, you know. She'd be one of those. And that helps to protect her and keep her in this cage of whiteness. She doesn't even realise she's in. So understanding that the world really is not black and white, understanding how many rules there are to keep us caged, it's a real journey. And also understanding now, the more and more I see how things really are and how complex and well thought out all of these psychotic rules have set out to be, the fewer and fewer people who do actually see it for what it is. So I think it's a very important time for me, in terms of growth, in terms of where I stand in this world, in this, again, watching that Michael Moore's documentary in this dying world, how important it is to actually stand on the right side of history. I don't know. That's what I've heard them say. Anyway, it's not on the right side of history, but it's true. Where do you want to sit on this historical timeline? Do you want to be one of the people who saw it for what it is? Or one of the people who continued to cover their ears and say, no, 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 it's not true, it's not true, it's not true, it's not true, it's not true. So, I hope you enjoyed the podcast. We're on almost in 55 minutes today. Special edition for the third one. enjoy the rest of the week. It's a Monday. And
What can I say? Stay woke, motherfuckers.